Thank you, Tom. Ladies and gentlemen, as you already know, Jim Rohr is our speaker this afternoon. He is the chairman, chief executive officer of PNC, and as you might expect, headquartered in Pittsburgh. What you may not know is one of the most diversified and one of the most successful financial institutions in this country. Tom mentioned a little earlier that they were in the top five on the capital ratios when he was talking about Jim a little earlier. What you may not know, in the very tough times that we've just been through, that PNC, in fact, has doubled its size in terms of its financials, its revenue, its profitability, not only due to its performance, but a couple of very strategic acquisitions. He's guided this company through this fantastic period of expansion, but based, as many of you will identify with, I hope, a values-based management style. In fact, in just the last couple of years under Jim's leadership, the company went from a $100 million commitment to early childhood education to today over $250 million. You may have read that Jim has announced that he'll turn over the reins at PNC. After more than a dozen years of being CEO, he'll retire next year as chairman. And that will conclude a career that has spanned some 40 years, all at the same company. He's a Cleveland native. He joined PNC after earning degrees from the University of Notre Dame, which he's on the board today, and Ohio State. He is a former American Banker of the Year and is known throughout the country as well as in Pittsburgh as a stalwart civic contributor. On a personal note, if I may, Jim and I have competed together for a number of years, as you might expect, in the AT&T Pebble Beach Golf Tournament. In fact, he's competed a little better than I competed. He came in ninth this year and has come in third in the past. As you might tell, we're good friends. He is really one whale of a competitor, and he's been an outstanding business leader, growing an outstanding company. Please give him a Naples welcome, Jim Rohr.
Holy smokes. Following you and the Reverend, it's not easy. Thank you very, very much, Mike, for that wonderful, wonderful introduction, and thank you for the invite to play at the AT&T. That was really special. And thanks for what you do, and thanks for what you do in Naples. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, and Reverend, thank you for your comments, I think. But for all the people that you've prayed for over the years, you know, there's still an opportunity to maybe pray for even maybe one finance guy. You know, it's not bad. But it is an honor to be here in Naples for a lot of reasons. I've got a lot of history here in Naples. I used to come here with Jack Donahue when he sponsored the senior tour event that was here in Naples. And that was a great experience. And then one time Jack came to me in the early 80s and he wanted to borrow $5 million. That was the account officer. So I said, okay. And he said, what's it for? Of course, you're supposed to ask. And he said, I want to buy a piece of property in Florida. And our bank was like $5 billion. It was very small. And they were too cheap to send me down to look at it. And he wasn't going to give me a mortgage on it anyway. And he showed me a picture of it, and it was looked like, I said, Jack, I said, this looks a little bit like a marsh. And he said, don't let it fool you. He said, by the way, it doesn't matter, I'm going to guarantee it anyways. I asked him if he was good for it, and of course he said he was, just like all borrowers. And it turned out he was. That piece of property was Pelican Bay, or a chunk of what is now Pelican Bay. And you know, Westinghouse developed it. Where's Doug Danforth? I saw Doug come in.
Right
There's a big hello, Doug. Good to see you. Doug was on our board back in those days, and of course Westinghouse did such a great job. And we used to come down and be with you and Janet at the at those great great events, and used to stay at Paul Lego's house where they had a lot of friends down here in Naples. And so it's great to have PNC here, and thank you for all of you that that are customers, and if you're not, you can consider yourselves prospects. It's great to have you here. But there's another reason why I'm pleased to be here in Naples. And obviously, I've known a lot of people in Naples over the years. And Naples meant to me, it represented to me the American dream. I don't know each and every one of you, but Naples has a whole raft of people, as I recall, from Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Chicago and places like that. People who showed up in their career, fortunate enough to get a good education, and somehow worked hard and ended up being fortunate enough to be able to be in a place like Naples. And I've always thought that Naples was really, the people in Naples were probably as much as any place in America, was the embodiment of the American dream. And what young kids like you were when you were young kids, what you were able to do in your lives in order to be successful enough to be able to retire in a wonderful place like this. And I've always thought about that. I think it's very important that we think about that. And I remember what Mike told me on the golf course. We were playing together at the AT&T, and I had just met Mike, and I was a young, very young CEO at the time. And he said, remember one thing, he said, about being CEO. He said, it means you're very lucky. Somehow nobody gets to be CEO without being lucky. You need an education. You need to work very, very hard. This is for the kids that are with us today, the students. But you also have to be fortunate. And people have to help you along the way. And it's about the people you work with that really get you ahead. And all of us have had that experience. And I think that really is part of the American dream. And Mike, I really appreciate you reminding me how fortunate you have to be in order to be able to get to that point. When I think about America today, and we look at a country that without a doubt is the most innovative country in the world. There's nothing like us. There's really nothing like America. There's nothing like the work ethic that we have in this country. We have a great work ethic. I don't think there's any question. The innovation that we take for granted in some cases is the best in the world, and it's created things like the internet that are remarkable. And you think about the internet, and we take it for granted a little bit today. But you know, we always think about the internet. People under 30, the age group that uses the internet the most, people under 30, right? People who use the internet the second most, people over 70. It's true. Think about it. You communicate it. What a wonderful thing it's enabled all of us to do. And I think about what I do every day now. I've taken this last week on vacation, you know, and I'm down here. Think about the Weather Channel. I watch it all the time. I talk to the people in Pittsburgh. You know, how are things going? Anyway, none of you do that, I know. But the innovation that we have and the things that we take for granted and the opportunities. The opportunities are almost limitless with what we could be able to do if we take the internet and take some of the pace of change that's taking place. And there's going to be a lot of change. If you stop and think about change, there's nothing faster than the pace of change that we have today. 6 years ago, there was no Skype, there was no Facebook, there was no Twitter. Blockbuster Video was the number one entertainment company in the United States. And Apple was rumored to be on the verge of bankruptcy. Think about how that's changed. We now have, and Mike grew up in Detroit, we now have the people buying cars on the internet. If you talk to the automobile companies, they will tell you, and a number of you probably are from Detroit, they'll tell you that people shop online for their car, and then they go to the dealer to pick it up. They look at all of the satisfaction issues and everything else. It's a change of life, but it's a wonderful, wonderful thing, and we're the innovators that are driving it. And so I think the future for America in this changing world is really, really special. I'm going to talk to you about two things, and I hope we have a lot of time for questions and answers, but I'm going to talk to you about two things that really trouble me, because when I think about where we're headed, there are a couple of things that are staring us in the face that we collectively have to do something about, and that is because we have really not done a good job for the next generation. If you stop and think about what we inherited, we did not inherit $17 trillion worth of debt. We inherited a few trillion, three or four depending on the time frame. We didn't inherit $17 trillion. We also didn't inherit a graduation rate in the cities of 50% or lower. 50% or lower. That's what it is. When you look around the country, the graduation rate is around 70%. It's a veil. It's a veil compared to what the problems we have in our city. Now, let me talk about the debt for a minute. If you stop and think about your own personal circumstances, if you were highly levered and the interest rates were zero, which is what effectively they are today, who bought a CD today? Yeah, what'd you get? Nothing. I mean, so the federal government is borrowing $16.5 trillion at, pick a number, 1%. Right? So it's a very, very low number. Say interest rates go up to 3.5 or 4%. Pick a number, times 3%, times $16.5 trillion. Now you're talking about another $600 billion a year of interest. And so this is a time, and the Federal Reserve is buying 85% of all the new bonds that the government's issuing. The Federal Reserve is going to take their balance sheet from $500 billion to $4 trillion. What causes a bubble more than a government agency? Remember Fannie and Freddie took their balance sheet from $600 billion to $7 trillion? What causes a bubble more than a federal agency? Nobody can borrow. Nobody does $7 trillion. Fannie and Freddie did. Nobody does $4 trillion like the Fed. And so that's what's kept the interest rates down. Say the interest rates go back up for whatever reason, and we all have been around long enough to know they will, you add that incremental interest expense onto the federal deficit, which is running about $1.5 trillion a year, and now you start looking at $2 trillion a year annual deficit, which drives the budget, drives the annual debt from 16.5 to 18.5 to 20.5. Now you get the downgrade, or the double downgrade, which increases your borrowing cost. That's the biggest issue we face today. They talk about the sequester. The sequester is 3%. 3%. Think about you. Think the students. You want to cut your spending by 3%. Trust me, you can figure it out. You know, like this afternoon, you know. I mean, and we can all take our favorite piece of the federal budget and ask ourselves what we might cut. But frankly, that is a big issue for us. That debt issue is a big issue, and it's an issue that can kill us. And every student coming out of high school today is inheriting $50,000 worth of federal debt. Every single one, 50 grand. And it's growing. And that's a big issue, and we don't talk about it. We talk about a whole raft of stuff, but we don't talk about this issue. And frankly, there's a whole raft of ways to deal with it. We didn't get here in 15 minutes. It took us 20 years to get here. You know, we're going to fix it over the next 30 years. But we need to get started. We need to get started, and that needs to be part of our conversation. The other issue is education. Frankly, when we think about the global world that we're in, it's much more competitive than the one that we started our careers in. It's a global economy today. And it's growing very rapidly. There's tremendous opportunities for us. But, you know, again, it's the people that we have. It's the work ethic and the education. We have graduation rates across the country that people will tell you it's around 70%. If you think about these major cities are around 50. I grew up in Cleveland. There's some Clevelanders here. I met some of you. Clevelanders, 55% of the people in the metropolitan area of Cleveland will not graduate from high school. That's a burden for all of us. It's a big deal. In Detroit, we're less than 40 in the city, actually, of Detroit. And so it's such an enormous problem, and it becomes a burden to the rest of us. By the way, it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way. And so PNC, a number of years ago, we did a study. We asked our employees, what if we were going to give incremental money to anything, what would we give it to? And they said education and children. So we went and did a big survey, and we're fortunate, very fortunate, that just at that time the studies were coming out of the University of Chicago and other places that talked about early childhood education. So the underserved child, you can discuss any, define it any way you want, the underserved child shows up at kindergarten with a 25 to 50% deficiency in vocabulary. Deficiency in vocabulary. And from that point forward, the gap between themselves and the average child grows. Doesn't shrink. There's all these wonderful movies that, you know, Mike Armstrong, which I know you've done, put your arm around Franny or whoever it was and it helped and turned out to be great. That's a one-off. We're talking about the system. The gap between that kid and the average kid grows. Think about it. When you know, I know 25 or 50% fewer words than you do, starting off in school. You're going to do better than I am. By the time I get to the fifth grade, you're getting A's and B's, I'm getting D's and F's. This high school stuff is not for me. This idea of going to college is not possible. And by the time I'm in the fifth grade, I will make a life decision. I make a life decision to do something other than pursue high school. Because it doesn't work for me. I can figure it out. I made a life decision when I was in the fifth grade. I looked like this. I couldn't run fast. I was not a track star, basketball, or anything else. You know, I played something else. We all make those life decisions because we realize how we fit. Fourth grade literacy is used as the single best predictor of the need for jail cells 20 years later by 17 states in the United States. Single best predictor. So what the studies show, that for every dollar we put into early childhood education, our society gets back at least $17 in lower incarceration, welfare, and rehabilitation money. It's the single best investment we can make. And so when you think about what's going on with a number of states, there's a lot of states that are now implementing this. We put in at that time, we committed $100 million, and Mike said we added another $250, so we're up to $350 million of early childhood education money in a thing called Grow Up Great, and we're doing it right here. Bob Seller, anywhere he is, we're doing it right here in Naples, where we actually go and pay our employees up to 40 hours a year to volunteer their time in early childhood centers. Those centers increase their capability. We fund them incrementally, and actually in places like Philadelphia, we've actually seen where math and science acuity goes up by 80% in a year. So it's amazing what you can do if you spend the time, but it has to be done locally. The idea that there's going to be some federal mandate is fairly difficult, because in certain states, Ohio, for example, took the funding away from early childhood education in a concentrated program and put it back in small ways, in communities, and it's turned out to be much less expensive. The state of Michigan has a program that they put in. Atlanta has a special tax for early childhood education. And so a number of states have done it very, very well. But quite frankly, there's more to do. And so when I think about just these two items, I talked about this being the best country to be in. There's no country that has a capital system like this. There's no country that has an innovative mind the way we do. It is, without a doubt, the best place to be in the world. But we have a couple of challenges. And I think, frankly, we have to address those. And, Frank, I'm getting, again, optimistic about it. Because, well, basically, I'm optimistic in the first place. But, you know, we need to make tough decisions, especially in these two areas. And frankly, you know, the conversations about the sequester, about the budget, I think frankly there's a lot of conversations about those. And you know, the pendulum always swings, you know, too far, and it's starting to come back. And I think we have to make sure that it keeps coming back. And the other thing is, in the State of the Union address, the President mentioned early childhood education, which is the first time that I've heard any president mention early childhood education in a in a forum that large. And, you know, the question really isn't so much that the federal government, I think the idea that the federal government will provide is not the answer for us. We have to do a lot ourselves. And what happens, and I think it's important for all of us, when we think about the Council for Economic Development or who we might work with to advocate things like the budget or things like early childhood education, I think it's not just the national program, but I think it's locally. Because I think it's going to happen locally. I think if we make sure that the leaders in our communities are engaged in things that worry about those two subjects, I think the rest of the country will take care of itself. We've got so many great things going on in America. You've seen, as Tom said, you know, the jobs program came out. It's improving. Next year we'll have a real estate business. That'll be nice. Been a while, you know, but it's coming back, and we can talk about that in your questions. But I think the future of America is remarkably bright. We sit on top of enormous energy resources, human resources. We sit on top of, without a doubt, the best economic model in the world. And frankly, the people sitting in this room are reflective of the American dream. And I think it's our job to make sure that our children and grandchildren have the same opportunities we do. So it's wonderful to be with you here today, and I'm looking forward to your questions.
Jim, thanks. Thank you, Jim. It's great to have a speaker who not only is a great business leader but a humanitarian as well, and who considers the community and a kid. So thanks for being here. Here are a couple of mementos, a couple of books. I'll take them back to the table for you. A little bit about Marco Island, a little bit about Naples, but thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And
President,
we'll get right to the questions with Mike.
As everyone knows, we have a ton of questions here that we'll never get through in order to keep our time. So, Jim, to the point, but let's start with the first one, which I thought was an interesting idea. I'd be interested in what you thought. Should the Fed put the U.S. government through a stress test?
We have the presses here, and so my good friend Ken Lewis is in the audience, and we're neither one of us are going to answer that question. I mean, if you have the ability to print money, what difference does it make in the short run? But in the long run, I think, quite frankly, we do. I think the point is, if you just make the assumption that the interest rates go up, which they will, the deficit goes up remarkably with it. That's what leverage does. $16.5 trillion is a lot of leverage. And the other thing is, you have to be careful of it. The new issue is, we're just going to let the rich people pay for it. That if you think that's the answer, you can't use, now I'm okay talking in Florida, but you can't use the $16.5 trillion number, because the rich people have to pay for the California debt too. And they got to pay for the Pennsylvania debt and the Ohio debt. And, you know, if that's the assumption, the $16.5 trillion number doesn't work. And we saw about the 13% tax rate in California. And by the way, I was out there last week, and there's a lot of people coming this way. There's a lot of people coming this way. So you won't see that stress test, I don't think, at the federal government.
Let's jump to education if we can. What makes a successful pre-K program, given all the criticism of the Head Start program?
Now I'm going to get in trouble. I'll talk to you about Head Start. Head Start was the last bipartisan thing we ever did. I can't think of it. I mean, it got, you know, 90% or 93% of all the votes. The idea was that we were going to do education, right? So Head Start became a big deal. Then later, when the unions decided that they didn't want to have somebody tell them what to do, they became against Head Start. And then it became a political football. And the issue for Head Start was, you know, there wasn't enough money to make it worthwhile. And that's always been the banter. And then they put through No Child Left Behind, and the exact thing happened to that. Exact same thing happened to No Child Left Behind. So, how about having a new bill? It's called Let's Leave Some Children Behind. I mean, you know, as opposed to not allowing it to be political, I'm certain that Head Start had many flaws. I'm certain that No Child Left Behind didn't have enough money. But quite frankly, rather than trying to think about what the right thing to do here is and really put together a quality program, we just basically capsized both of them. And now we're starting all over again. So it's a, I think frankly we need to come together on this issue. It's the right thing to do. It's not a political issue. Shouldn't be.
This one's also quite straightforward. Is Dodd-Frank really going to prevent the next too big to fail?
Too big to fail. What Dodd-Frank has done, what it's in a number of ways. There's 300 rulings and 100 studies. It's a massive document. But in the final analysis, the most important thing it did is it made all the banks double their capital ratios. And so, that's going to help, make sure the banks are stable for a long, long period of time. And so that helped. I mean, the other part is it's going to be very, very expensive. To comply with Dodd-Frank, it's actually taken credit away from some of the needier people in America, and it makes the whole banking system more expensive. I will tell you, I predict there's another issue coming. Some of you do online banking, and we have these denial of service attacks, cyber attacks on the banking industry. Make no mistake, our government's not worried. Our government's not worried about an army amassing on the Rio Grande anymore. And they're not too concerned about missiles either. But cyber attacks are very critical. And the power grid is the other thing. Those are the two weak points of our country. These cyber attacks are serious against the banks. 96 gigabytes a second, we were attacked for 22 straight hours. 18 straight days. Pounding away, trying to deny service, not to break into our systems and to steal your money. We never shut down. Thank God we had a lot of great partners. AT&T is one of them. But the cyber attacking is a big deal. And with regards to too big to fail, we might get to a point where you're too small to survive, too small to protect yourself. And those are the things we're worried about now, because if they are able to get inside of a small bank and then pretend they're the small bank coming to the large bank, it's a different issue. So that's a big issue for us, and I think the banks are working very hard on it. We are not set up as a country with our laws and with our infrastructure to defend ourselves against it. And so it's a lot of work that's going on right now. So I'm more concerned about too small to survive than too big to fail. The double capital helps the banks.
We all have heard, and you mentioned it in your speech, that with all the printing of money, there's inflation ahead. Could you give us some of your insight in terms of the factors that we ought to be looking out for that when that inflation is going to start to unfold on us?
Well, I'd love to know when that happens. That's like that would be a good thing. That's like having next Monday's Wall Street Journal. I only want it once. When you look at the productivity gains have been so significant. When you look around at the utilization rates of plants and equipment in our country, we're in the 80s. There's a long ways to go before we start running into capacity. I don't think we're going to see inflation around for a while. And when you look around the world, there's not a lot of inflation around the world either. And occasionally you'll run into, We've got some problems with refineries, so the price of gas is going up, but now it's starting to go down from a peak period already. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of inflation anytime soon.
We were talking a little earlier about some of Jim's background with Sally, and this question is, what's the future of Sally, Fannie, and Freddie?
Well, Fannie and Freddie are interesting. There's a lot of discussion now about what to do. If you would take, and some of you can go back to, I was on a thing called Fannie Mae Watch in the 90s. We used to go meet with Greenspan and say, this thing is going crazy, and one of these days you're going to be left holding the bag. And he said, no. And as a matter of fact, I used to go with Bill Harrison and Kovacevic and myself and some other guys and talk to Chairman Greenspan. And he said, no, the Congress loves housing. And then it grew dramatically. It levered itself 40 to 1 and became the holder of all the mortgages. And so we know how that ended. If you went back and looked at the charter, the original charter that Fannie and Freddie had, they were supposed to buy mortgages and facilitate securitization. They were not supposed to have a $7 trillion combined balance sheet. They weren't actually supposed to be a publicly traded company listed, leveraged at 40 to 1, funded by... It was supposed to be a securitization, a guarantee vehicle. And I wouldn't be surprised, frankly, if it just goes back to doing that. And if they go back to doing that, I think that would be great for the country. You would have a guarantee agency for 30-year paper. We're the only country in the world that has that. But then they wouldn't be leveraging government funding on an unlimited basis in order to make the spread between the short and the long, which always comes a cropper. So I would like to see them just go back to their original intent, which would be the guarantee agency.
Many of us have read the Simpson-Bowles report, and at the heart of that report was addressing entitlements. You referred to the national debt, but the mathematics suggests that entitlements are at risk. Could you comment, please?
To this room. And we got the local Naples newspaper here.
I guarantee you everybody in this room is interested in Social Security.
I am, too. I am, too. I mean, I'm 64 and a half. When you spend time in Washington, they all tell you, no matter what agency you're with, they say, we can fix Social Security. We said, okay, how do you fix Social Security? They all have the same answer. None of us are going to like it. You can move the starting age by a year. You can freeze the benefit. And you can have a means test. And when you do that, the problem goes away. So I said, well, why hasn't anybody fixed it? They said, because the people who would have to consider a means test wouldn't do it unless the money was taken out of the federal budget and set over in a trust that said, okay, I'll give up my Social Security, but I'm only going to do it if the money's put in a trust and I know that the thing is fixed, because I don't trust you to do it any other way. And when that's said internally at all the agencies say, that's a non-starter. We're not willing to take the money out of the budget. We like to have it in the middle of the budget. We like to have our fingers on it. And so you never hear that. And I've heard it probably in 6 different agency offices. And and frankly, they won't touch it. And so it's obviously a political hot button, but nobody's willing to actually consider. I mean, you saw what happened to President Bush. He literally threw the issue on a table and said, maybe we can privatize this. Tell me what else you think we might do. And that was the end of him. I mean, that was the end of the issue. He got wiped away. So, I mean, it is a big issue, but it's one of these things that. If you tinker with it at the edges, it can be okay. But, the idea that somebody's going to, the problem's going to go away, it's not going to go away. It's a big issue.
Now, this is a question for me, Jim, because we have a common interest in elementary education, and you said something so profound that the best way to predict the incarceration rate in the country is to look at the fourth grade. And that's so true. And we also talked, both previously and at lunch, about the impact of some of those dollars in the area of performance learning. Could you share with the audience some of your comments?
In terms of early childhood? In terms of early childhood education?
Yeah.
Well, there's studies that will tell you that you learn how to learn in your first 3 years of life. We have some scientists here in the room. They understand that. I'm not in a neuron business. I don't figure it out. But evidently, if your mother sits and reads to you when you're 1 and 2 and 3 years old, not only do you end up with a better vocabulary, but you also learn how to learn better because of brain development. That's all I know about that. It's 150% of what I know. There's no question. All of us can understand if you show up with a 25 to 50% deficiency in vocabulary, you will learn at a slower pace than the kid next to you. And you will have a problem. And what we've done is in the places, and we've now touched over 2 million kids with our early childhood program called Grow Up Great. And what we do is we allow our employees to find places that they will volunteer their time. We'll pay them 40 hours a year to do that. And then these sites that are selected by the local regional president in each community we're in, where we enhance the early childhood education. And then we measure the progress of the kids. And we have a program in Pittsburgh. It's a bunch of Indian kids where we actually improve vocabulary by over 50% of the same kids year to year. And in Philadelphia, we improve math and science by 80%. And we do this with partnering. We're not experts at this. I mean, we partner with the early childhood centers. Grow Up Great as partners in Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and PBS Kids. And really by doing it with partners and actually allowing the partners to do a better job with the kids. And, you know, it just gives them a better chance. There are no guarantees. The one thing we can't do, unfortunately, is when the children leave the early childhood centers and go into public schools, the public schools won't keep track of those kids vis-a-vis the other kids. And so we're not able to keep track of how the kids progress in other years, but you have to know that they must do better because of their positioning. And so there's a lot of different early childhood education programs that are being built state by state, community by community around the country, and I think it's very exciting that it's happening.
Two more questions, Tom, if I may. You mentioned cybersecurity and hacking. How safe and efficient is this online banking system?
Mm-hmm. I think it's been attacked by as ruthlessly as it can be attacked, and I think there's a lot of backstops to the online banking system. If you stop and think about how things are changing so much, check writing used to be a growth business. As a matter of fact, till 4 years ago, check writing was growing at 4% a year, and then it started falling at 15 and 20%. Online banking growing 20% a year for each of the last few years. We kicked this thing off where you can take a picture of your deposit with a cell phone, and that's how you deposit your check with your cell phone. We're now receiving 12,000 of those a day. And we didn't tell anybody we were doing it. We just turned it on, and people started using it. And you're not financially incented to do it either. And so with branch traffic going down, and not just the people under 30 are the ones that are using the Internet. I mean, everybody's using it. It's changing a lot. And the security is quite good. It's quite good. So I'm not nervous about it at all. Back to a question that the Reverend raised. Is that in the surveys say the person they trust the most is their clergyman. The person they trust the second most is their banker. Now, when you ask who you don't trust, Congress is at the bottom, and the banks are in there right with them. I mean, we're second, we're second or third anyway. But it's like your congressman, your banker, but right behind the clergyman. So there's a lot of people that work very, very hard to make sure that your money is safe.
Last question, Jim. You've been a builder all your career, all your life, and you're about to retire next year. Any plans in terms of keeping building?
Well, first of all, the building question is an interesting one about real estate. You can't leave Florida without saying something about real estate. If real estate is coming back, and I don't think it's moving back nicely now, and by the time we get to next year, we'll have a real estate business. What happened in many parts of the country is that when we put everybody in subprime loans, subprime housing, we took a bunch of people who were really renters, and we put them into brand new homes. And so now with all the foreclosures and what have you, many of which take years to process, they're now going back into rental properties. And guess what? The rental properties aren't there. They aren't there. They were converted. They were torn down. They were converted into, senior citizens. They were converted into something else, schools, whatever. But they're not there. And so multifamily housing is under construction rapidly across the country. And there's less, and one of the reasons is there's less than a 5% vacancy in apartment rentals in the country. And so it's making housing much more attractive, and a lot of houses are down. So you're going to have a housing business, especially with these low rates, next year. So I think building is something that's going to be good for the economy next year. So as we continue to grow out, I think that'll be good. Be good for Florida, too. In terms of myself,
yes.
I'm still going to be chairman for a year. I'm on a few other boards. I'm on a couple of college boards, Carnegie Mellon and Notre Dame. Those are fun. I'm on four corporate boards and a few civic things. So I think there'll be plenty to do. So I'm looking forward to enjoying a lot of things.
We sure hope you come back to Naples. Ladies and gentlemen, thank Jim Rohr.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks, Carter. Thanks, Mike. Good to see you. Thank you.